Hey, welcome to Your Turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us today, and we're going to be following the money as per usual. Today we're going to take a look at the federal benefits package, and this is one of those things that you probably can't know too much about it, and my guest today knows just about all there is to know about it, John Elliott. Longtime Fed, now retired. He worked for OPM, Agriculture, Customs, DEA, and Interior, I believe. And he was, where agencies were after him, and he kept moving from agency to agency because they wanted him there. So,
John, one step ahead of the sheriff.
Well, that too. I did see you on America's Most Wanted. But anyhow, really glad to have you with us today. And my point is, not only do you know the regular FERS and CERS, but you know the law enforcement, the LEO process too. And that can sometimes be helpful. We advertised in the column this morning for people to call in or send us email us questions, and we got a batch of questions, and I think it's probably good to go to those first because they're, some of them are of general interest, but if people took time enough to email us, at least we can do is answer them, or at least John can do is answer them. First one is from Gunny, and I bet he's a former Marine. He says, if you have Medicare Part B and FEHBP, that is Blue Cross Blue Shield, I understand Part B is primary. What if a doctor does not take Part B? Will the FEHBP be primary in this case? If not, any ideas?
Well, yeah. I mean, FEHB has to pay the whole. Yeah, they do.
Okay. Good answer. Okay.
But if I would caution people to check with their doctor before they take Part B, and if they say they don't take Part B, they're not a Medicare participant, in other words, then either you got some choices to make. One, don't take Part B if you want to stay with your doctor, or move to another doctor if you want to take Part B. Now, whether to take Part B or not is a longer discussion. I think we have a question on that coming up,
yeah,
which I'll elaborate on
okay
when we get to it.
All right, simplifying. This is from Dave. He says, my wife worked in the 1980s for the government. She started as CSRS, Civil Service Retirement System, had a break in service, and then came back as a FERS employee, Federal Employee Retirement System. She repaid her retirement contributions from her CSRS time in order to keep that time. She worked a total of 8 years and left in 1990. Does she get a FERS retirement at age 62 based on those 8 years of service? Boy, yeah, I'm glad you're here.
Yes, she does. But let's see. Did she say? I'm looking at this question. She worked in the 80s, but under CERS, but he doesn't say how long. Oh, no, 8 years and left in 1990. Well, she has a CSRS component because she has at least 5 years of CERS, apparently. And then she came back as a FERS, as he said. So she gets one annuity check, 8 years under CERS rules, and the however many years she has under FERS, that will be her annuity. So the answer is yes.
Okay, very good. Here's one from Ted. It says, in the second to last paragraph of today's column, what are you doing the rest of your life, you ask, will you want Medicare when you turn 65? We know anyone reaching age 65 must apply for Medicare Part A. Applying for Part B is voluntary, but if someone does not apply within a certain period of time after they're eligible, the cost begins to rise on an annual basis. It appears a retiring Fed can obtain medical insurance through the FEHBP cheaper than the cost of obtaining Parts B, C, and D. I'd love to see some discussion in an insightful article about this. Can you sort of elaborate, John?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at what your coverage with FEHBP is, and also the key question you ask is, what is your health? And if it's poor or fair to middling even, I would consider taking Part B, which covers doctor's expenses and outpatient expenses and the like, lab costs. That's all Part B. So then I would take it. But if I'm in good health and I have no health risk factors, I'm not terribly overweight, I exercise, you all know what the health factors are, positive and negative, you might not take Part B. I didn't, because I am a low consumer of medical services. I see a doctor once a year for an annual physical, and my GEHA plan pays for all of that. And so I could be paying upwards to, you know, $1,800, $2,000 a year, depending on where the premiums are for Part B that year. And that's money I don't get back. Now, as he rightly points out, because I delayed, I'm 68 now, just had a birthday. I'm going to pay at some point this year, or if I enrolled next year, I guess, during the open enrollment, I'd pay 30% more than if I'd signed up at 65. But let's say I get a cancer diagnosis. I say, well, Part B would then be cost effective because I'm going to be seeing the doctor a lot. I can still take Part B and pay the 30% over higher the premium. Regular premium. Mm-hmm. So that might be cost effective. If it isn't, I wouldn't. But it just wasn't cost effective for me because I'm in good health, rarely get sick, knock on wood. And so it's simply do the math to decide whether Part B is right for you.
My mother was a retired civil servant, and she had, I think, Blue Cross. I talked her into getting long-term care insurance, and she had Social Security. And she was a walker. She didn't own a car, so she was in her mid-30s. But fabulous health up until the very end, and then wham, it all hit, and it was Alzheimer's, and the long-term care, the combination of Medicare, long-term care insurance, and the federal program was a lifesaver for us and the family, and it was a dignity issue for her, too. Okay, got one here from Sue. Says, tax and time-wise, does it make more sense to take the 30 days annual leave the end of retirement instead of cashing it in and letting it be taxed with little return?
Well, if you do the math, it's better to take the lump sum, and almost everyone does. It would take you a dozen years or more, typically, to make up that lump sum you didn't take. So you can do the math yourself. You know, do two annuity estimates, one extending 30 days, one not, and then find out how long it would take you to make up the lump sum, and I'll bet you it'll show you it'll take you a good long time to make up the money you didn't take.
Right, got one here from Tim. Tim says, thanks for taking my question. I started my civil service in March 1984 and have been informed by our agency specialist that I'm eligible to retire in 2018. Can you assist with understanding the impacts of retiring early? Do I require a VERA, that's a voluntary early retirement authority, or a VSEP, which is a buyout, to maintain the annuity?
Well, it's up to the agency if they're going to offer, one, early out, and two, if they're going to offer a so-called buyout, a VSIP for short, but that's typically been $25,000 before taxes are taken out. Did he say he was FERS or SERS? He didn't say.
Doesn't say, but he said he started in March 84.
Okay, let's take SERS first. Well, then he'd be FERS.
Okay,
that answers that. Thank you. Under FERS, there'd be no particular impact. You can retire early if you're age 50 with 20 years of service, or 20 if you have 25 years of service, doesn't matter how old you are. Under FERS, there's no age reduction for retiring early. There is for SERS, but he's FERS. He's got to be FERS. So there's no age reduction, so your annuity would be based on the regular FERS formula, based on how many years and months of service you have at the time you go. So there's no impact there. Plus, if you have your health insurance for 5 years immediately preceding your retirement, you take that into retirement, which is key. I wouldn't retire early unless you'd met the 5-year requirement. Because that health insurance is incredibly valuable. But no, there's no particular downside. If you've done the math, you think I can afford to retire, or I'm going to another career where I'm going to get paid. So, yeah. No downside
very,
that I can see.
Very personal question, too. Okay, last one from Sharon. I'm due for my last in-grade step increase, GS-13, Step 10, in March 2015. Should I wait until after that date to file my retirement papers, and will the in-grade increase my high 3 for CSRS annuity purposes?
Well, first of all, any increase or decrease in salary in your high three period, for 99% of it is just increases. However long you're at a particular pay level is prorated. So if you only had a few weeks or a month at the step 10, she says she's a 13 mm-hmm. step 10, it would have little impact on your high three. It would raise it ever so slightly. So the longer you work at a 13 step 10, the greater your high three, you get more right. of that step increase effect. To get the full effect, you'd have to work full 3 years at a 13 step 10.
So it is prorated, and it would help a little,
prorated.
but it's probably not something to stay on for other reasons.
Again, you can do the math, but no, it's all salary increases in your high three period are prorated based on how long you were at that salary.
Okay, need to take a short break here on Your Turn. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Glad to have you with us today. I'm talking with John Elliott. He is a benefits expert, longtime federal worker, now retired, and he works with the National Institute of Transition Planning, and they do seminars all around the country. You've even been out of the country, haven't you, John?
Yeah, once. Italy once.
That's amazing. Near
Florence. Italy.
It's wonderful. I mean, I think sometimes government workers don't appreciate, you might have a different view, but don't appreciate it. But yeah, I see what the government does for people in things like that versus what the private sector does. And the government, trust me, is light years ahead in most instances. John, you made me a list of things to be aware of before retirement. Let's just go down this list here. You said review OPF. What's that?
Well, it's official personnel folder, and it used to be literally a brown folder, and maybe some places still is, but a lot of them go into electronic records, but I imagine they still call it the OPF, or you want to name it a file since we've gone electronic. Whatever it is, it's a complete record of your federal history, not just your current agency. All your agency service should be contained in that file, maintained at your current agency. So when I say review it, and I do it sooner rather than later, I wouldn't, several
don't
years.
Don't wait the last 2 weeks, huh?
Oh, no. I would say a year to 2 years in advance. Look at your OPF and make sure all your service is recorded in that file. And you can make an appointment with your HR, a.k.a. personnel office. They maintain the files. And make an appointment to review it. Now, if you're in a remote location and your file is in actually a paper folder still in around Washington and you're in Montana, your HR office can get you copies for you to review. That's essential to do.
And you're also obviously looking for errors in there.
You're looking for missing history. That mm-hmm. would be key. You'd like to look at... if your federal health benefits form is in there, that's important to establish the fact that you had your health plan 5 years immediately preceding retirement, things like that. Just make sure everything is copacetic so there are no issues at retirement or shortly after retirement that need to be addressed. If there are problems, let's say you're missing they're missing an agency you worked for.
Yeah.
OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, that is, has established procedures in the SERS-FERS manual to reconstruct missing history. And the SERS-FERS manual is written for benefits officers, retirement counselors, what have you, and they can go through the procedures to reconstruct any missing service. That doesn't happen very often. I mean, chances are your file is complete and accurate in the vast majority of cases. So I wouldn't worry about it, but I would check verify that trust but verify.
Yeah. Well, I remember to deviate a little bit. I had a friend who was with the government, and she had worked in Chicago for Uncle Sam for some X number of years, then left government, and like many people, thought she'd never come back, so she took her retirement contributions. She came to Washington, rejoined the government, and was told by our HR office that she would not be able to retire to a certain date or she'd have to repay this money. And I remember at the time that you and I had a conversation about this, and there was some magic window or something, and I put you in touch with her, and I brought her to tears. The news you gave her was so good.
Well, her service history presumably wasn't missing. That was she had withdrawn her CSRS
exactly.
retirement funds and then returned to federal service. And she thought that, I guess she...
HR told her that they gave her erroneous information.
Right. Okay.
You straightened it out.
I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I didn't hear what GSA said. Yeah. But she fell under this law where all her service... for which he took a refund was before October 1st of 90, and which meant she didn't have to pay it back, and she got full credit for that service, except she did take an actuarial reduction in her annuity. But taking the actuarial reduction is far less painful than coming up with a boatload of cash. I think she owed $80,000 to $100,000,
right.
Which is not untypical. So
instead of having to pay it all back, as she thought, she's paying it in, I guess, monthly increments.
Well, she shouldn't be paying it back.
Okay, it's just a smaller annuity.
It takes, yeah, because it would take you at least 15 to 16 years, if not longer, to recoup that mm-hmm. lump sum you handed over to OPM
yeah.
in higher annuity payments. So it doesn't make a lot of financial sense to pay it back.
Yeah.
Now,
well,
by the way, that 10-1-90 date was extended in that flurry of laws that was passed in 2009 to now March 1st of 1991. So that's
there must be a reason for that.
Well, anyhow, I'll tell you a reason
yeah.
for that. It was some member of Congress
exactly.
or their staff, which is
yeah.
whenever we get something good, you can almost bet that it's to benefit a member of Congress or their staffs.
A former head of that unit long ago once told me, long after he retired, that no significant piece of legislation, particularly dealing with retirement, ever passed Congress that didn't benefit some member or staff member.
That is true.
Yeah. I mainly wanted that example is this was an intelligent woman. She had an intelligent helper, but they were wrong. They were wrong, and you
oh,
were
you
right.
You do get wrong answers, both from your HR office.
Well, as you said, trust but verify.
And also, you get wrong answers from Social Security
yeah.
people, too.
Here's number two on your list. Obtain your civil service retirement or your FERS annuity, the Thrift Savings Plan, and Social Security estimates. So how do you do that?
Well, you can do them yourself. There
mm-hmm.
are calculators for all three, both the SERS, FERS. There's a calculator at OPM's website, opm.gov. There's a website called FedCalc, FedCalc.com. I've used that. It's pretty good. The TSP calculator is at TSP.gov, and the Social Security calculator is at SSA.gov. So you can do them yourself, which I kind of recommend, but your HR office has the capability to do it. And a lot of agencies have put software for general use on their intranet system, whatever it's called,
mm-hmm.
Calculators that you can use at your desk. A notable one is EBIS, which is DOD, at least Department of Army, and it may extend to the other DOD elements. But so there are plenty of calculators available. Reason I do them myself is not because the HR would make a mistake, but they can, and you can check them. And plus, you learn things by doing these estimates. And they're not hard. You sit at your computer and plug in the information, and it spits out a figure. And the only way it can be wrong is if you make an input error.
All right. So, speaking of getting it right and whatnot. You have on the list here, attend a retirement seminar. And I know I've been to a number of retirement seminars. You have conducted a number of retirement seminars. And the one thing that I seem to notice from people is the questions that come out. It's a serendipity factor. And people ask things that would not necessarily be on the list, and you can really learn an awful lot about it by being, it's sort of the reverse of the wisdom of the crowd. The crowd has the questions, and the seminar of a presenter has the answers, hopefully.
Yeah, I rarely got stumped,
mm-hmm.
And almost never. But sometimes you get some doozies, but that are more judgment calls or, you know, what are your opinions of annuities, you know, mm-hmm. But that's the factual type stuff. Your instructor should be able to answer 99%, if not 100%, of those types of questions, factual questions. If it's a matter of opinion about something, you know, you can decide whether you want to accept that advice
or
not.
Plus, the seminars in government are free. The government pays for them, but the attendee doesn't. And in many cases, they will let you bring a spouse or significant other, I think, correct?
Yeah, it's quite common. I know the ones I did, spouses would show up as well. Not all of them, but, you know, there'd be a minority of class members that would bring their spouses.
Okay, take a short break here on Federal News Radio. We'll be right back talking with John Elliott, the benefits expert. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn, talking with John Elliott, benefits expert in the government, and as good as they get. And John gave me a list of do's and don'ts for people who are even considering retirement. And one of them is, and we've alluded to it twice, but it's the five-year rule. And it's one of those things, if you don't know what the five-year rule is, you could be in big trouble when you get ready to retire.
Yeah, it's simply you have to be enrolled in an FEHB plan. In one of them, not the same one for 5 years, but you have to be in the program for 5 years immediately preceding retirement. Now, if you're in the military and you're covered by TRICARE, either as the military member or your spouse, that will serve to meet the five-year requirement. But if you're in that situation for, well, I've got TRICARE, I know it meets the five-year requirement, but you want to leave your options open to carry FEHB into retirement, you at least have to be enrolled in one of the plans on the date you retire. Then what some people do, and I get a fair amount of questions from military about this, after you retire, you can suspend your FEHB if you don't need it, and then reinstate it during any of the annual fall open season after you're retired if you later find you do want or need FEHBP. So that's the five-year requirement.
Right.
Now, you also meet, it's important to know, and I got a question about this the other day, where the questioner didn't realize that as a family member, it was a two-fed family, she was covered under her husband's family plan, and she didn't realize that she met the five-year requirement
right.
by being covered as a family member. That my spouse, my wife, carried the FEHBP, so I was under her family plan, so I met the five-year requirement. One reason she had it instead of me, and it didn't matter other than the fact that I was going to retire first, and the spouse that's still working should maintain the family plan to get the tax break.
Because
once you're retired, that tax break, that pre-tax benefit goes away. So that's another thing to consider. So whoever retires first, if you have the family plan, have it transferred to your working spouses, if
right.
federal working spouses.
You can suspend but never quit, right?
Well, you can always quit. That's not a good
idea. Don't do that.
You don't want to quit.
Yeah. Here's a question we'll maybe lump together. Do I provide a survivor benefit and how much? And also, how much life insurance will I still need when I retire? And I've had a couple of questions from people who say their life insurance agent urges them to buy life insurance rather than provide a survivor annuity. And I can see why a life insurance agent would think that's a good idea. But Survivor annuity is forever, correct?
A survivor annuity is forever. It's indexed to inflation just like yours is. Under SERS, you can provide your spouse with your widow or widower up to 55% of what you were getting, or you can provide a partial. Under SERS, you can provide as little as a dollar a month. And why would people do that? That sounds kind of perverse. Well, situations where the spouse says, hey, I don't need a survivor benefit. I got my own money. I don't need it. Why should we reduce your annuity to pay for it between 9 and 10% or whatever amount if I don't need it? Well, okay. But you need some level of survivor annuity if the surviving spouse lives after the federal retiree with
for health insurance.
Yeah. Right. So that can be key.
Yeah. And a buck would do it. A buck a month.
Yeah. Base level would be on your application $22.
Yeah.
That's as low as you can go. A lot of people under SERS will do $3,600 because you're only reduced 2.5% on the first $3,600 of your annuity. And so the spouse would get $1,900 a year or something like that, 55% of the $3,600, and that might be enough to pay for a self-only FEHBP out of her annuity, and that she wouldn't have to write checks to OPM every month, which
right.
they'll let you do if your annuity can't cover.
Yeah, but why bother? Yeah, you're right. Here's one that always brings a smile to people's faces, and then reality sets in, and you think maybe this is a fairly serious question after all. I knew a retirement planner one time, and he said he used to tell the husband or wife, whoever the spouse of the person he was counseling, he said, pretty soon you're going to have half the income and twice the husband or wife that you now have. And you're talking about thinking about being with your spouse 24/7.
Well, it's going to happen at some point. You're going to be home together, presumably, for most people. And it's better to, kind of thrash out those issues in your mind and, of course, with your spouse. Retirement is one of the top 10 stressors we can experience, according to the psychologists. And I had no stress.
Yeah.
I was happy to retire. I was going to a second career doing retirement seminars. So I had no stress. But my spouse, also a retired federal employee, she didn't think she was undergoing any stress at all either. But she experienced shortness of breath to the point where once she insisted on going to the emergency room when we were out in San Francisco visiting our daughter, which was scared my daughter. But I kept telling her, no, it's stress, because she'd been to the doctor before that and nothing wrong with her. Nothing. They couldn't find any cause of this. So I said, well, it's psychosomatic. And we ran into one of the counselors that does part of our seminar at our annual party, and she said, yes, that was retirement stress. That shortness of breath is I've heard that before. I've seen it before. So my spouse, of course, your spouse never believed you,
exactly.
But she believed her.
Get a third,
second
source.
She believed
source.
Her.
Yeah.
So that's another thing you have to look at. And what are you going to do in your retirement? Are you both going to travel? Are you going to travel separately? do you have a big enough dwelling where you can each have your own room with a TV and where you're not jammed together? Things like that. You just have to kind of map out in your head, how you're going to deal with that. It's not going to be all of one glorious cycle of song, to quote Dorothy Parker, but, it should go well. Presumably, if things in your marriage are generally good.
Well, the Washington Post had a piece today, I think it's a Pew Research Service thing, about sharing a common password in a common computer. But Lauren Larson, our producer here, is giving us the evil eye. You're not giving me the evil eye. Okay. Do we need to take a break? Okay. She's not giving me the evil eye, but we do need to take a break right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Mike Causey, welcome back to your turn. Thanks to John Elliott for popping in and giving us a great overview of the benefits thing. Now we're going to be talking with Nicole Blake Johnson and Andy Medici. They are writers for the Federal Times. Folks, are you there?
Yes, it's good to be here, Mike.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for holding on. Interesting stuff going on here. And Nicole, I know you're the IT expert around your office, and you've been looking at the Navy Yard shooting and what the security reforms that's led to.
Yeah, it's definitely been interesting. I started off, you know, looking at what was the latest with identity and access management, and I came across some interesting work that the Defense Department is doing, specifically within their Defense Manpower Data Center, which I hadn't heard too much about before working on this, but, you know, under their purview falls oversight of the DoD CAC cards, which they use to, you know, get into buildings and computer systems. Well, they had been working on technology that would allow installations to communicate with each other and send alerts, you know, whether there was an active shooter on base or other incidents or information they needed to share with each other, as well as being able to pull information from an FBI database if someone, you know, was on the wanted list or they had a felony, different things like that. So you could know, you know, for people who have regular access to my base, is there any information out there that I should know about this person before allowing them to come onto the base? And so this was something they had been working on for a while. But, you know, with the Navy Yard shooting happening, it really sped up the process. For them now, it's really working through the legal piece of this. There's some policy in place that, you know, ensures that DoD does not collect, store, disseminate information on people that aren't affiliated with the Defense Department, except in limited circumstances. So really, they're at the point now where they're piloting this technology within the Air Force. They're using this to, you know, track what's the status of people who have access to the base. It's really interesting, some of the data they've been able to collect on this. There were 335 people they identified over the past 3 months who have access to Air Force bases who, you know, were involved in some, you know, weapons activity, drug charges, different things like that, where it might raise a red flag as to, should we just be allowing this person access to our base unescorted to roam freely wherever they wanted? And of those 335 people, a little over 100 of them actually came to the base trying to get in, and they were stopped and evaluated, and a determination was made. Are they a threat? Should we not let them in, or should we go ahead and let them in? So it's some neat stuff they're doing. They're looking to expand that across the Air Force. I know the Army's, you know, on the verge of rolling out the system. So some really neat stuff they're working
on. And this is for real. We had the Navy Yard thing. We had the shootings at Fort Hood, and just, you know, amazing stuff. I know this is going to be probably being investigated for years, but was there an issue about the Navy Yard shooter, or I guess I should say the alleged Navy Yard shooter, who really shouldn't have been there?
Well, the fact that he had different run-ins the law. And so I asked specifically, would a system like this, and it's actually called IMESA for short, and that stands for Identity Management Enterprise Services Architecture, long name, but IMESA for short, I asked, could this have prevented something like the Navy Yard shooting? And Defense Department officials have acknowledged it could have helped, but I'll tell you one thing. They first need to make sure that they're scanning the CAC cards, because scanning the card triggers, you know, the system to say, hey, let's look and see, is there a red flag? Should we let this person in? So the fact that he had a history with the law, you know, there's a chance that, you know, if that information had been fed from local law enforcement to this larger system, that they could have at least made a determination, should we have let this person?
Let's watch this
not?
Guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Andy, I know you've been looking at security clearances, and I guess this is in the wake of the Snowden affair and some other things like this.
Yes, you're right, Mike. You see, there's been a lot of close looks now at security clearances. You know, Edward Snowden, there's been a lot of high profile people who've, you know, leaked information or who've gotten access to classified materials. And lawmakers and agencies alike are sort of reviewing, you know, how many people do we need to have, you know, top secret clearances or secret clearances, and how do we manage that, you know, especially with some of the issues with contractor background checks and reviews recently. You know, Congress and, you know, agencies are definitely taking a hard look at who should have clearances and what that process should be.
Well, The other, oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, and just to add to that, in working on this story specifically about the installations, I know that, you know, DOD, they're also working on a system to continuously vet people who have security clearances. So whether it's, you know, looking at foreign travel or other information that they need to collect to determine, first off, should this person have a clearance, to follow up on those data points to say, hey, is a red flag raised? You know, should we go and investigate? Does this person need to continue to have their clearance? So Andy's exactly right. They're
well, and OPM is taking back some of the security or the clearances process, are they not?
Yes, that's correct. There's sort of a review process at the end where contractors were sort of asked to grade their own work, and OPM is definitely dialing back on that and pulling that back in-house. And, you know, that's what we always talk about this, Mike. It ends up being what role is inherently governmental and which ones are not. And, you know, contractors who were doing the background checks were also asked to check their own work on background checks, and OPM's decided that I guess that's going to be a little bit more inherently governmental than it used to be.
Yeah, and that was privatized during the Clinton years, I believe.
Yes, you know, there was a big push to reduce the time it takes to get security clearances, and once during the Clinton administration and once sort of early on after the September 11th terrorist attacks, you know, to reduce the security clearance time it took to get those checks. And, of course, now we're looking and saying, you know, to get to that 60-day marker, where contractors being a little less than full and fair in their evaluations of background checks.
Well, it shows, too, the stressors that are put on government workers and in certain jobs. The same people will tell them to speed up the process and yet don't miss anything in the process of speeding up, and at the same time gather all the information you can but don't invade their privacy. And you think, how am I going to do that?
Well, you know, sometimes they're given sort of the impossible chance. And, of course, you know, you have to do all of the things that you just mentioned and, you know, do it with maybe 7% less this year. And at the end of the day, you have to make a choice about what you're willing to sacrifice. Do you want a short timeline and you might end up having contractors do this? Do you mind having it be 90 days or 120 days and you have to wait longer, but you might have a more thorough vetting? You know, and a lot of times, you know, members of Congress don't feel the need to make those sorts of trade-offs, so it sort of falls upon the federal worker to make those calls.
And they've been known to change their mind, too, up on the Hill there. And Tom and Emily this morning on their show talked about this cybersecurity framework, and Nicole, I know you're up on it, and it's coming out Wednesday. What is it? I know Tom asked the question, what's a framework?
I was just talking to Andy about that earlier, and how NIST, which is the agency that's really taking the lead on this, how they describe the framework is a collection of best practices and voluntary standards. So it's not essentially a checklist to say, all right, company X, you need to do X, Y, Z, and this is how you do it in order to ensure that you're secure. Rather, they are saying, okay, identify first what is your security posture? And then here are certain standards that, you know, NIST, working with industry, have identified that you should put in place, like, you know, tracking all of your physical devices and systems that you have within your company. You know, making sure that, you know, cybersecurity team and HR are working together so that you're doing personnel screenings. You know when someone has left and what access they still have to your systems. So with the framework coming out today, you know, you have industry waiting. You have some who already have their opinions on the fact that, you know, this is a great first step, but, you know, with the lack of cybersecurity legislation actually passing Congress, this was a necessary first step.
You know, I wish if I were king, I would ban certain words and make people explain them other ways. Listening to some of these, not yours, but some of these people, you have to have transparency. It has to be robust. There are silos, and I just love it. The conversation, the way it is confusing to ordinary people.
I absolutely agree. And this is a group that you don't want them to be confused, because that's been the problem. We're talking about major systems that if they're impacted or they're, you know, down and not working, they could cause, you know, great physical damage. There could be, you know, loss of life. So these are people in industry who you need them to understand the lingo, and you need to break it down and be clear, because they're operating systems that affect all of us.
Yeah, I'm for transparency in that case. Andy, we've got about a minute left, but are we talking about another BRAC, another base realignment and closure action?
Yes, definitely. You know, the new time frame for everyone out there, it's Army officials and DOD officials are pushing for 2017, and I know that they've been rejected a couple times before, but I'd just like to note that DOD has always been rejected a couple times before they were eventually approved for a new round of BRAC. So the new push is 2017. They want to model it after older BRACs from the 90s that were significant consolidations. So for all of you, you know, for all of you workers out there, you know, that's a time frame that they really want to get now is 2017.
Well, the good news is it probably means more federal workers and people that follow them coming to the Washington area. The bad news is traffic.
Well, that's always the problem, right? And we could talk all day about traffic, but, you know, unless there's real money there, you know, that's just probably going to get worse over time.
All righty. Andy, Nicole, thank you so much for being here. Talk to you next week. Have a good week. And everybody, remember, the snow is coming, so make your peace, get your snowshoes out. We'll see you next week.